Hello and welcome to Barstool Biology. I'm your host, Gary Somerville. Today, I have my first ever guest on the podcast. His name is Dr. Andrew Hogan. He is an immunologist by trade, and he is a principal investigator, which is fancy science jargon for someone who runs a research lab. He's based in the Obesity Immunology Research Group, and immunology is his jam. So who better to have on this podcast than Andy, who can chat to me about our immune system during a viral pandemic and how we can overcome SARS-CoV-2. But he's not just a science nerd like me. He's a bit of a celebrity. He's presented his own TED Talk, and he's also a former world champion kickboxer. So as well as kicking lumps out with diseases, he's pretty good at beating people up as well. But interestingly, he's never taken me up on my offer for a sparring session. And because it's Barstool Biology, we will of course be having a virtual pint, despite being separated by 3,000 miles of freezing cold Atlantic Ocean. So sit back, relax, as we serve up science in the form of immunology and vaccines. So I'm joined by Dr. Andrew Hogan. Thanks for joining me on Barstool Biology. You're my first ever guest, so you should feel absolutely honoured to be on this podcast. How are you doing, Andrew?
All good, Gary. Yes, I'm very privileged to be the first guest, and well done on the first episode. Very, very good listening.
Thanks very much. And we're going to be talking about immunology today, so what better man to have on who someone that does immunology for a living. So can you give the listeners just a brief background about what you do at St. Vincent's University Hospital before we get into the juicy stuff?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Gary, I'm an immunologist by training. So we investigate the immune system, and my particular area of interest is around obesity. And so obesity is linked to over 200 different diseases, and kind of at the heart of a lot of that is a lot of immune dysregulation. So changes in the immune system that drive these diseases. So for the last 10 years, in kind of collaboration with Professor Donald O'Shea over in St. Vincent's Hospital, and we've been investigating how obesity impacts the immune system, and also really interestingly how the immune system regulates your body weight.
Good. And we actually collaborated. I might put that paper up in the link, but we collaborated, what was it, a year or two ago now, where we were looking at some of the immune responses in obesity.
Yeah, a couple of years ago, we kind of looked at a particular cell within obesity that we think might kind of be contributing to the development of type 2 diabetes. And we kind of got down into it using your technology, some of the potential mechanisms behind that, and that was published, I think it was 2 years ago now.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I mentioned in the intro there that apart from being an amazing scientist, you are also a former kickboxer. So can you tell them, you know, it's a bit of an interesting combination to be, you know, a world-class kickboxer as well as an immunologist. So can you just give the listeners a brief background about that and how you got into it?
Yeah, I guess I'm not your usual nerd, you know. I'm a little bit bigger than most people. No, I guess it kind of almost ties in with some of the research we do. So I would have been heavy as a kid, and I kind of went looking for sports. I was never really into team sports or field sports. So found a local kickboxing club, which was kind of next to our school. Got involved in that and kind of realized, you know, being kind of bigger than most people and having a really hard head, I was actually all right with kickboxing. And then kind of got to see the world with it, got to travel kind of all over the world with it. So I was lucky in that way. But I'm definitely now retired and I'm a broken man from it, but had some good times.
To say you're not a standard nerd is a bit of an underestimation. If you saw Andy in person, what are you, 6'5", 6'6", something like that?
Probably 6'5", in the bare feet.
So a big mountain of a man, knocking some of the diseases around that we have going on right now. And is there any COVID work going on in the hospital there, or what's going on?
Yeah, so we're actually at the moment, our lab, so I must say that my lab now is kind of based out in there's a new Institute for Health in Maynooth University, which I know we're both alumni from.
Yep.
So we're looking at some COVID responses in patients. And we're particularly interested in this, Gary, because, again, coming back to obesity, our patients with obesity, it seems that they're getting a more severe COVID infection when they do get infections, and their prognosis is more severe than people who have a healthy body weight. So we're trying to figure that out at the moment. So we're about 50 COVID patients into our research at the moment, looking at, again, the immune response to COVID. And hopefully we'll be able to tease out why some people get a more severe disease compared to others.
Very good. And yeah, we're actually working a little bit on COVID samples ourselves in our lab. So hopefully further down the line, when everything kind of slows down a little bit, we can do another collaboration. So as I mentioned at the last episode, the good news is the body's adaptive immune system does have the ability to recognize SARS-CoV-2, just like any other invading pathogen and mount an immune response. And right now, there's about 90 vaccines trying to be developed against SARS-CoV-2 by research teams around the world. But that's going to take a while, and we'll get to that later. Until then, most of us who encounter the virus, we will rely on our guardian angel immune system to seek and destroy. So, Andy, as an immunologist, can you tell us what happens during a normal immune response to something like SARS-CoV-2?
Yes. So I guess the immune system can be broken down kind of into two parts, Gary. There's the innate part, and what that basically means, there's a part that responds almost immediately. And what it does is it kind of responds in a very non-specific way, and it generally keeps the invading pathogen, so in this case, the SARS-CoV-2 virus, it keeps it under control until the body can come up with a kind of a more specific, detailed way of handling it, and that's your adaptive system. So they're probably about 3 days apart in the responses. So for the first 3 days, your immune system kicks in, tries to keep the virus under control, tries to keep the damage to a minimum, all while training your adaptive immune system how to deal with this pathogen. And then when that kicks in, you've got two types of cells that respond, one of them being your T cell that can kill the virus, and then your B cell will produce antibodies, which will help kill the virus as well.
So the word antibody has been is being thrown around so much now with antibody testing. Can you just give the listeners in one sentence, really, what actually is an antibody? Because people are probably hearing it all the time. And if you were to ask someone in the street, well, what's an antibody? They may not actually have an answer. So by your definition, what is an antibody and what does it do?
Yes. So an antibody is a protein basically released by part of your immune system, your B cells. So they produce these proteins that are very, very specific at targeting kind of viruses and bacteria and stuff like that. So what happens is, in this case, your body will produce antibodies that are very specific for proteins that are expressed by this virus. And they have the ability to bind to the virus and actually neutralize it.
So the majority of people who encounter this virus right now are mounting an appropriate immune response, and that's why they only feel kind of mild symptoms. Is that right?
Yeah, so basically a lot of the evidence is emerging so fast, like the science here has been done at a rate that I've never seen before, you know, and we might talk about it later on, but stuff that usually takes years is taking months here. So but what is emerging definitely is that patients who have had COVID-19 have got neutralizing antibodies in their blood, it seems, for the most part. And they also have a specific T-cell memory to it, which is really encouraging, because what that tells us that, you know, potentially, you know, we have got some protection from reinfection from this.
Okay, yeah, that's a very relevant point, because yesterday I was reading, this is pre-peer review, so as you said, some of the science, the rate at which the science is being done is incredible, really. And there's so much more, just to get the information out there, there's so much more information now in the pre-peer review process. And a paper I was reading yesterday, I'm not sure if you read this one yet, Andy. It's from a cohort of just over 1,000 patients in New York City. And they found that a lot of people who were confirmed SARS-CoV-2 by the PCR test were actually mounting some IgG antibodies. Now, if we compare that to some former coronaviruses that we've encountered, like SARS and MERS, the evidence there suggests that, yes, it does give you some level of protection for a couple of months, but perhaps not long term, which is why we may need a vaccine. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, so again, and there's people more expert in this, Gary, than me, but definitely it looks like if you have the antibodies, you know, from looking at the, as you said, SARS and MERS, which are kind of coronaviruses that have caused previous outbreaks, you'll definitely have, like, it looks like 3 months protection minimum, which is encouraging, because what it does is it just gives us time to kind of get these vaccine trials underway and kind of hopefully a successful one into production.
Yeah, and rolling in very nicely. It's like you knew what I was thinking there, Andy, about the clinical trials. And making new drugs, it does take a long time and it costs a lot of money. Like, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It costs a shitload of money. Typically, we see a clinical trial can take up to 10 years and it can cost over $1 billion in R&D for a drug company because, as I'll get into now in a second, along the way, some drugs will drop out of the race and each one of those candidates costs time, money and effort. So I'll dive into real quick why this process takes so long. And before a clinical trial starts, all these new candidates, they go through something called preclinical research that assesses their features and are carried out in animal models. So we've both worked with animal models directly or indirectly over the years. Some of these can be mice, monkeys, zebrafish. There's lots of different animal models that are used for these. If the results are good enough, the tests and treatments go through a series of clinical trials, and that's mainly to assess that they're A, safe, and B, work effectively in humans. So there's five phases. Some people may have only heard of four. So phase zero, they're the first trials done. Their aim is to learn how a drug is processed in the body and how it affects the body. These are very small dosages given to about 10 or 15 people. Then you have phase one. They involve about 20 to 100 healthy volunteers or people with the disease or the condition. And they typically last a few months. So we're already getting into the few months category, which is, you know, we're already a few months into this pandemic. And yet here in a typical clinical trial, we're only at phase one. And the purpose of that is to establish best dosage of the drug with the fewest side effects. And here about 70% of drugs move on to the next phase. So after phase one, Andy, we're already seeing that a few candidates are dropping out and, you know, a lot of time and money would have went into those. So we're already down 30% of the candidates. Phase two, that's to assess the effectiveness and the safety of the new drug. And they're tested on a few hundred patients. So again, starting to scale up from phase zero to phase one and phase two. These particular trials take several months, sometimes even up to 2 years. And only 33%, my favorite word as a dub, 33% of the candidates go to phase three. So it's really starting to get whittled down. Phase three, they compare the new drug to the standard of care treatment, and they can be up to 3,000 volunteers who have the disease or condition. These typically take 1 to 4 years. And its main purpose is to examine drug efficacy and seeing if there's any adverse reactions. And about 25% of these make it through to phase three. So through to phase four, rather. So by the very end, when it's getting approved by the FDA, there's very few viable candidates left. And those at phase four are tested in several thousand patients. This allows for better research on the short and long-term side effects for instance, some rare side effects may be only seen in large groups where you may not see them in a handful of people. So at phase four, you're really trying to dial in, is there any side effects? You've already established that the drug is working effectively, and then it can be actually dispersed for widespread use. So like I said at the start, Andy, typically this can take 10 years, and everybody now, like all these companies and research institutes and academic environments that are all working against a vaccine, like, I don't personally, I can't remember such a time where there's been such an effort to join the race and try and get a vaccine against SARS-CoV-2. So given a kind of conservative estimate based on what I just said about how long a clinical trial can take, is it viable really for us to see anything? Personally, I can't see anything by the end of the year, but even early 2021 or mid 2021, do you reckon that's actually possible?
Again, yeah, and as you said, usually these things take many, many years, but obviously there's a pressing need here above and beyond the normal circumstances, Gary. I think what's coming out is that it's definitely going to be 12 months. So, you know, at the very earliest, you know, you're looking at this time next year. Realistically, it could be 12 to 18 months, which kind of pushes us towards, you know, September or towards even late next year. But one thing that's kind of encouraging is that some people had already been working on, say, these kind of platforms where you can take a protein and kind of plug it into the platform, which speeds everything up. So rather than starting a vaccine from scratch, they have these ready-made templates almost that they've, especially the likes of MERS and SARS, that you can just take out their proteins, put in the coronavirus one, and that has definitely sped things up. So I know in Oxford, the Jenner Institute in Oxford, I think they're approaching phase two already. if not in there already.
Yeah, and there's a company here which I may have even mentioned on the last podcast, Moderna Therapeutics, and they're based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They're actually, I believe, they're approaching stage two as well. So it's moving very fast, isn't it? Which is, I guess, good, and you know, it could cause concern for some people. I'm guilty of reading comments on social media, and a lot of people are worried, like, you know, oh, well, how good is this going to be if it's being rushed into production? Is that a valid concern for people?
No, well, I think that obviously there's going to be due diligence done here. And the people who are leading these, you know, they're the world experts in this. And what we have seen is that there's been a kind of consolidation of focus. So what I mean by that is all the world's experts are working together, where usually science, you know, is collaborative, but there's always a little bit of competition, you know. But definitely within this, and you can kind of see about even the preprints where people are sharing their data very quickly. And that all just helps to kind of make sure that things are going as quick as possible. But there's going to have to be some oversight. So you don't want to do is, you know, release something that isn't effective, or even worse, you know, ends up kind of damaging people. But the clinical trials will still be adhered to, you know, just they will definitely just move quicker.
Yeah, and some people may be wondering, well, what goes into a vaccine, or what exactly is a particular vaccine? And there's a few different types, so maybe we can dive into that. So, for example, a virus vaccine, that's a weakened or inactivated form of the virus, and many existing vaccines are actually made in this way, such as the ones against measles and polio. But the issue there is they require extensive safety training, and normally these vaccines are weakened by being passed through like an animal or human cell in the lab, or they can be inactivated virus vaccines, and they're inactivated by stuff like heat. So is there any other, you know, there's a few different vaccine types here. Is there any ones you'd be looking at thinking, you know, these ones have real potential here?
Yeah, as I said, I think some of the ones, Gary, the likes of viral vectors. So I know there's some viruses which are, you know, they can get into the body, and what they do is they kind of express a small bit of the virus you want to protect against, but they use a kind of a less dangerous virus to kind of get it into your cells or into the body. So some of the viral vector vaccines, you know, are showing some promise as well. As I said, as are the nucleic acids. So there's this, you know, you mentioned the last day about DNA and RNA, you know, and for the most part, these are, the body really responds to seeing these, because these should be held within the cell.
Mm.
So some of the nucleic acid ones also have, you know, great potential. And as you said, there's 90 of them in kind of clinical trial. But for the nucleic acid and the viral vectors, I think there's 45 of those in a clinical trial at the moment, or in development.
Yeah, and that's that, to touch on Moderna, that's the technology they're going with. They're using their an mRNA, so messenger RNA company. That's typically how they do things. So they're using the mRNA, the genetic instructions, so for the coronavirus protein, and that will prompt an immune response. But it seems to be, that's a very, it appears to be the nucleic acid arena seems to be quite a new way of getting these vaccines made. So it's possible that they may have to do a bit more due diligence on those, would they, just because it's such a new technology?
Yeah, no, definitely is. The idea of using nucleic acids as vaccines is newer. Usually kind of the viral vectors is probably a bit more established, and then the protein based, where, you know, you take the protein that is expressed by this virus and you show it to the immune system, and they recognize and respond, are probably the more classical. So as I said, some of these nucleic acid vaccines were in development for other viruses, so there has been a lot of work done on them and a lot of validation, and now I said what they're just doing is they're repurposing them for SARS-CoV-2. So hopefully some of the kind of the groundwork has been done previously, and it kind of gives it a bit more security that it's not going to go wrong on us.
We'll move on to, so now that people have learned a little bit about why clinical trials take so bloody long, and also some of the different types of vaccines that are currently being worked on, as I said, there's over 90 of them right now. So really the scientific community is banding together, and even like ourselves almost, our kind of scientific focus has slightly shifted, purely because this is, like you said, a pressing need right now for the scientific and global community. So you'd have some labs who typically work on, pick a disease, they're kind of pivoting now to some COVID research, because that is like the priority right now, that we have to learn more and develop some therapies against this virus. So everybody's kind of buying in and rowing in the same direction, which is great. Now, one thing we'll touch on is herd immunity is being thrown around everybody, by everybody and by every news article or news agency you can find. There's a mention of herd immunity, and it's mainly because this is the approach that Sweden are trying to go with. So can you explain, Andy, what exactly is herd immunity?
Yes. So I guess what herd immunity is, it's an in kind of indirect way of protecting from the viruses. So the idea is that if enough of the population is either kind of protected from the virus or has immunity to the virus, that it protects the people who haven't had it. Now, generally what happens is you kind of look for, 90% of your population to be protected from the virus. And what happens is that should then save 10% who aren't protected from it. Now, usually how we do that is through vaccination. So vaccination is kind of definitely how you get herd immunity. So, you protect the majority of the population against a kind of virus. And what it does is it protects the people who, for whatever reasons, can't be kind of vaccinated.
Mm.
I think in the setting of SARS-CoV-2, I think it's a bit worrying that we're kind of, people are talking about, let's just achieve herd immunity, because there's two things. First of all, as we just said there, you're talking about, at a very minimum, 75% of the population have to have SARS-CoV-2 infection to be to get herd immunity. Now, with that, when you start doing the kind of maths around, the kind of number of people that it kills, you're talking about millions of people dying, absolutely millions of people dying to get to that point. And the other thing is that, say, for example, the science that emerged from Spain shows that actually in Spain, only 5% of the patients or 5% of the population are seropositive, which means that, it's ongoing there a good few months. They've had a lot of deaths and still only 5% have kind of antibodies. So there's a long way to go until they kind of hit that magic number of 80%.
And then when you address those numbers to Sweden, like Sweden has 10 million people there, and currently right now they have a case fatality rate of 12%. So if they're trying to achieve natural herd immunity, if you will, without any vaccine being used, like that's going to be a huge cost of life. If their fatality rate is so bad already in comparison to its Nordic neighbours, like Norway and Finland have less than half the death rate that Sweden does. Like, how is that a feasible option for them going forward? Will they have to reevaluate what they're doing there?
Yeah, it's not a feasible option. And I think kind of some of the early reports that, Sweden kind of were going on as normal and, they had very low cases, we're starting to see that's not true and not accurate. But what must be pointed out is that, although Sweden didn't go into a lockdown and they kept a lot of things open, from listening to some of their epidemiologists, the way society is working over there, people are at risk or staying home, restaurants are empty. And actually the Scandinavians are quite disciplined, they're not the party animals that the Irish would be. So in general, they're a little bit more reserved. So I think their culture, itself has protected them a little bit, but definitely this kind of goal of getting the herd immunity, it's not going to happen without a vaccine. And, for anyone to try and kind of state that this is the way out of it, they're going to let millions of people die potentially.
Yeah, and you're right about Irish people being party animals, because it's 8 a.m. here and I've gotten an American IPA sitting beside my microphone. So yes, the Swedes definitely aren't the same as us in that regard. One fantastic and actually amazing stat I read there during the week was that it's just probably helping the Swedes, is that 50% of households in Sweden only have one person in them, which is crazy. I couldn't believe that, but I guess that's helping the social distancing. If there's only one person in the house and, they're not spreading it to two or three other people, and those two or three other people are spreading it even more. So maybe just the way society is in Sweden, that's kind of inherently helping them. But if it wasn't, like, what would their fatality rate be if they didn't have, if the Swedes by their nature weren't, more willing to social distance and stuff like that, would it be a lot worse?
Oh, absolutely. I think, as I said, when we hear about Sweden, there's this kind of probably misinformation that Sweden is going on as normal, but you know, it's definitely not. Like they have got very strict measures in. They just haven't completely locked down, like say, for example, we have here in Ireland and they have in the US. So, but definitely there's still all the kind of the social distancing measures, the hygiene measures, they're all still in place. It's just that they haven't closed their businesses. And so it's probably not completely accurate to say that Sweden is, it's life as normal over there, because I don't think that's fair. But also I think that they're now starting to see some of the, as you said, this kind of elevated case fatality rate, you know, compared to Norway and Finland, showing that what they're doing probably isn't the best approach.
Yeah, it's certainly one that's igniting debate, all right, because you've got a lot of virologists and epidemiologists saying this is crazy. And then I think you have the head of epidemiology in Sweden is saying, you know, this is the way we're going about it and we're going to get through it. But yeah, from us kind of outsiders looking in, and it would seem like a bit of a crazy prospect. But you have both sides, really. You have people hailing Sweden as, you know, you've got people who are looking for just the US, for example, to open up. They're kind of looking at Sweden and they're saying, well, their economy isn't being crippled and all those type of things. But then you have the people who are kind of more on the medical scientific side are saying, well, yes, but you know, the death rates are higher than here in other countries where they're in the single digits. So there's definitely kind of two sides to the coin. So going forward, like, I think worst case scenario, the virus can infect many people if we just do nothing. And I think the models have suggested that, you know, if you do nothing and just let it go through, it's going to be a bad situation. The best case scenario, if we can maintain current levels, reduce the levels until a vaccine becomes available. But that kind of requires extensive social distancing and locking down. So do you think, Andy, is the most likely course of action we take is kind of in the middle somewhere, where perhaps the infection rates kind of peak and trough and we can relax the social distancing measures when they're falling, and then if they start spiking again, re-implement them? Is that something that's possible to do, or it's just, you know, people may start just giving up or rebelling in some states over here and just be not bothered with it, or just going to go back to their daily lives as best they can?
Yeah, I think, as you said, the balance has to be found. Like, we can't all stay indoors for 18 months, but we also can't just go back to normal, you know, and kind of let a lot of people die from this. So I think what's coming out is that the evidence around the social distancing and the hygiene and even face masks, you know, will allow some sort of return to, you know, normal everyday life. And also then on the kind of medical side, there is some treatments which seem to be effective at, you know, reducing the severity or reducing even the stay in ICU. And a lot of this, when we talk about flattening the curve, what it was to give our hospitals a chance to deal with the cases. Mm-hmm. So now you've got medications that, you know, are reducing the stay in ICU. And a mixture of all of these kind of measures, both the social measures and the medical measures, I think will allow us to have some sort of normality, you know, until we get the vaccine.
Sure, yeah. It's very much a team effort. Like, everybody has to buy in. And for a single individual, it might not seem like too much. They're like, ah, well, you know, I'm only one person. But if everybody has that mentality, well, then we're going to go nowhere. So definitely people have to buy in. And just, you know, you see in some other countries in Asia, they kind of all banded together, for want of a better phrase, even though they did it remotely. And they kind of suffered together for a few weeks, even a few months. And now they're starting to go back to some levels of normal life. So it definitely needs a bit of team effort and people buying in. Before I let you go, Andy, we do this thing called a shot of science. And I know I'm putting you on the spot here. Have you got any little nuggets of immunology that may blow people's minds that they've never heard before? So in the last episode, I was telling people how every cell in their body has 3 billion pairs of letters. Is there any crazy immunology facts you want to give the listeners as their shot of science for this week's episode?
I think the best one that we've come across lately is that, and people will actually probably find this somewhat comforting, is that it's really hard to lose weight because your immune system protects against your body losing weight.
Well, personally, I appreciate that information. That's when I come out of this quarantine and I'm about 20 stone, I can use that excuse as to why I let myself go to shit. So I appreciate that, Andy.
Not at all. And just one other thing as well, I'm talking about the relaxing social measures. I don't know whether you've seen that there was a big outbreak. So Korea, obviously, you know, they did the best testing, I think, in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe Germany might challenge them for it. And they released some of the kind of, you know, measures there recently. But there was a massive big outbreak in a nightclub. And it turns out that the supermarkets are all right, your restaurants are probably all right, but the nightclubs might have to keep closed a while longer because people just kind of lose all rational thought when they go into a nightclub. So,
yeah.
Nightclubs might have to stay closed for a while longer.
I think when people have a few beers on them, kind of all bets are off in regards to, you know, social behaviours and hygiene and all that sort of stuff. So that's definitely a no-brainer, but something that the Irish people won't be happy to hear about, that the pubs and clubs might be staying closed for another while. Andy, thanks so much for coming on to Barstool Biology. Appreciate your expert immunologist opinion. Really value your input. And best of luck on all the COVID work and every bit of work you're doing there, St. Vincent's. Appreciate your time.
Cheers, Gary. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to Barstool Biology and learning all about our immune system and how we can fight COVID-19 going forward. Before I go, a massive thanks to all of those who have subscribed to the podcast so far and given fantastic feedback. It's great to see so many people enjoying learning about science. If you're loving the podcast, giving it a review about why you like it on Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts would be fantastic. And similarly, if you have friends, family, side pieces, even your pets that would be interested in learning some science, by all means, send Barstool Biology their way. I'm Gary Somerville. This has been Barstool Biology. Tune in next time for more facts and not feelings, where I will be serving up science.